Good evening, I'm Judy Woodruff on the NewsHour tonight. As the death toll from COVID-19 continues to spike, lawmakers work out a new round of economic relief. I talk with the Speaker of the House, Nancy Pelosi, about Congress's response to the virus. Then, the hunt for a vaccine. Our Miles O'Brien on the race to find a treatment, the only surefire way for life to return to normal. Plus, the pandemic abroad, how medical officials in Uganda are putting their experience with past health crises to work. And scenes of silence. Cities around the world come to a standstill as COVID-19 maintains its grip on the globe. All that and more on tonight's PBS NewsHour. Round four of rescue aid is on its way through the U.S. Congress tonight for millions of Americans hurt by the pandemic. Meanwhile, infections worldwide have topped 2.5 million, including well over 800,000 cases and nearly 45,000 deaths here in the U.S. Amna Nawaz begins our coverage.
Senate will come to order.
On Capitol Hill, a renewed effort today to mitigate the economic pain of the COVID-19 pandemic.
This is even more money than we had first requested a while back.
The depth of the crisis we now face meant that funding for certain programs in this bill had already been depleted.
The Senate passed a nearly $500 billion relief package, including funds for hospitals, testing, and new money to boost a small business lending program that's now dried up. Negotiations had stalled over how to ensure the money goes where it's most needed. An Associated Press analysis found at least 75 big companies, all publicly traded, had received a combined $300 million in low-interest loans through the initial program rollout, frustrating small business owners like Zachary Davis.
A company that's doing tens of millions or hundreds of millions a year in revenue is going to be first in line with a big bank when it comes time to apply for one of these things.
Davis said he scrambled to apply for funds for his Santa Cruz, California ice cream shop, but was shut out. The lack of funding in the new congressional package has also frustrated leaders of hard-hit states like New York.
I think it's a terrible mistake not to provide funding for the states. I get small businesses, I get airlines. How about police? How about fire? How about healthcare workers?
Governor Andrew Cuomo flew to Washington after that briefing to meet with President Trump on the continued need for state resources. That meeting followed an overnight tweet from the president declaring he would be, quote, signing an executive order to temporarily suspend immigration. Texas Congressman Joaquin Castro, chair of the Congressional Hispanic Caucus, accused the president of diverting attention from his, quote, failure to stop the spread of the coronavirus and, quote, take advantage of a crisis.
Even before the president's tweet, immigration to the U.S. had largely been shuttered after years of administration policies to limit migration and recent steps in response to the pandemic, including suspending cross-border traffic and restricting incoming air travel.
Meanwhile, outside the White House today,
if you don't protect us, we can't protect our patients.
Members of National Nurses United, the nation's largest union of registered nurses, protested the lack of masks and other protective equipment.
It's scary. It's extremely scary to not know whether or not you're protected enough to take care of these patients and know that you're not going to get sick and pass it on to your friends and family.
Medical workers say they continue to be strained. The Washington Post reported the director of the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention, Robert Redfield, warned a second wave of COVID-19, likely to coincide with the next flu season, could be even worse. This as new virus hotspots are still flaring up across the country. Massachusetts is now trailing New York and New Jersey in the number of infections and deaths. Governor Charlie Baker reported a surge in hospitalizations today.
The data shows we're still very much in the grips of a pandemic here in Massachusetts. Now, I know that's hard to hear and it's hard for me to say.
At the same time, some states where infections have yet to peak are already moving to reopen their economies.
Open America now!
Hundreds protested in Raleigh today to pressure North Carolina's governor to do the same. Overseas in Italy, once the global epicenter of the pandemic, Prime Minister Giuseppe Conte said restrictions would likely be lifted beginning in early May. Meanwhile, the World Food Program warned today the number of people facing hunger worldwide could double this year to nearly 265 million due to the continued economic fallout of the pandemic. For the PBS NewsHour, I'm Amna Nawaz.
That economic fallout hit oil prices hard again today, and that in turn took down Wall Street again. The Dow Jones Industrial Average lost 631 points to close at 23,018. The NASDAQ fell 297 points, and the S&P 500 was down 86. And now to help us dive deeper into the details of the Senate's relief package, I'm joined by our congressional correspondent, Lisa Desjardins. So, Lisa, it's fresh off the floor of the Senate. Tell us what the main pieces of this legislation are.
Right. Let's break this down right away, Judy. Here's a look at what's in this. First of all, $320 billion to extend the Paycheck Protection Program. That's basically to keep small businesses able to keep their employees on for another 8 weeks. There's $60 billion in addition to that for small businesses for what's called economic disaster loans. That money had also run out. $75 billion for hospitals and other healthcare providers, and then $25 billion for testing. Some of that is going to the National Institutes of Health, and some of that could go, much of that is also going to states and cities.
So, Lisa, talk some more about the new money in here, money for example, for overlooked communities.
Right. This is what Democrats, one of the reasons they were holding out and they thought felt was very important in this bill is $60 billion specifically targeted for smaller banks. Banks that don't profiles. Why is that? Well, let's take a look at some data that just came out yesterday from the National Small Business Associations. They found that from their members, if their member had more than 20 employees, that 52% of those members were able to get help through this program. But for small businesses with fewer than 10 employees, only 18% were able to get the help through this program. That corresponds to what Amna was talking about in her story about very large businesses getting help, small businesses not. Democrats were able to put money in this bill specifically for these small banks. Some are rural, some are urban, but most of them don't have as much access to this capital. Also, quick notes, Judy, the testing program, this bill requires a national testing plan from the Trump administration within 30 days. And down the road, it requires that there be data based on race, gender, and location as to who is contracting and who is dying from this virus.
And what everybody wants to know, Lisa, is when will this money actually reach people?
Well, the House plans to vote on Thursday. That will be a full House vote. Many members will have to return for that. After that, it goes to the president. He's expected to sign it quickly. I'm told by experts that once the president signs this bill, this money can be flowing to businesses very quickly within just a few days, maybe just one day, because a lot of the architecture has already been established for how this works.
All right. Lisa Desjardins reporting on what's happening at the Capitol. Lisa, thank you.
You're welcome.
And now, with the bill on its way to the House for a vote, we bring in the Speaker of the House of Representatives, Nancy Pelosi. She joins us from Capitol Hill. Madam Speaker, thank you very much for talking with us. We just heard Lisa lay out the main elements of this legislation. Tell us what you think the main difference this bill is going to make for people.
Well, as usual, Lisa did a very good job of putting forth the particulars of the legislation. Thank you, Lisa. What's important here, though, let me begin. I always use temporal markers. 2 weeks ago from today, this Tuesday, 2 weeks ago, the 7th of April, the Secretary of the Treasury called me and said, I need $250 billion. That would be a quarter of a trillion dollars. And it'll be on the Senate floor in 48 hours. A quarter of a trillion dollars in 48 hours. I said, I don't think so. The very next day, on April 8th, House and Senate Democrats proposed an alternative that would reach the underbanked, so many of the small businesses, as well as expanding opportunities for those involved in the PPP. Also, with the recognition that we're only going to open up our economy if we can address the testing, contact tracing, and other issues that relate to science and health, in addition to the economy. They're so connected. So that was 2 days later, on the 9th of April, Leader McConnell brought to the floor legislation that said, this is it, $250 for PPP, which we fully support. But nonetheless, we needed to do more and adjust for those who were underserved by it. This is it. This is all we're going to do. And the Democrats are holding this up. The fact is, he was holding up what came to the floor, and they just passed, under his leadership with Chuck Schumer, the legislation that was proposed on that on the floor that day, but he rejected our legislation that is much fairer, much surer in recognition of the use of science and how we go forward. So we consider this very positive and a good use of the time that it took. It could have been saved if they accepted then what they're accepting now. What remains, though, is for us to go forward with another bill, and we can talk about that if you wish.
I do want to ask you about that, but very quickly, what we're learning is that there was a smaller than expected percentage of small businesses who got money from this last piece of legislation. And many of the businesses who got it were bigger businesses in great shape. How do you know that's not going to happen again?
Well, because we have a $60 billion set aside for these very, shall we say, underbanked business women and minority-owned businesses, Native American, rural veterans, all kinds of businesses that would not be, shall we say, on the first-come, first-serve basis getting these loans. That now is different. And that's thanks to Maxine Waters and Nettia Velasquez, who, as one chair of the Banking Committee, the other chair of the Small Business Committee, put together this proposal, which was today voted unanimously on the floor of the Senate. And so that is our attempt. Now, we want to see the data to see how this is working, both what has happened already and what will transpire as we go forward, to make sure that we are reaching those who are the lifeblood of our economy, small business, all of it, very small, too, for creation of jobs and wealth in our country.
So much to ask you about, Madam Speaker. I'm going to move quickly here. We know that Democrats wanted money in here for state and local governments. Today, the president tweeted that that's a priority for him in the next legislation. Does this mean you're now on the same page?
Well, we have always had that assurance. They didn't want to do it in this bill, but they would do it in the next bill. And his announcement, of course, is no surprise to us because that's what we have discussed. We could relent on some of that because we know this next bill is going to happen very soon. But we don't even call it state and local. We call it our Heroes Bill. This is about our health care providers, our police and fire, our EMS, those transportation workers, those essential workers who are, in many ways, risking their own lives to save other lives, but are at risk of losing their jobs. And so we want this to be about them, our teachers and others who are so essential to our society and our economy. So we're glad to hear that the president said that, but it's no surprise to us because part of moving on from this was to go to the next bill. In the previous, the CARES bill, we had $200 billion. They had $150. We went with the $150, and then we didn't know about the interim bill until they called a couple weeks ago because we were prepared to move on with a bigger allocation in the next CARES bill.
And just confirming, the House vote, we expect that on Thursday. Anything to say at this point about proxy voting or virtual voting in the House?
Not on that day. On that day, we will have a vote by members present and voting. As we go forward, though, any change in that would require rules change. That would have to be voted on by the House of Representatives. And so we can consider that. But for now, we don't have that rules change, but we do have the urgency of passing this legislation, which we will do in a very strong bipartisan way. And all of our bills have been bipartisan, starting with our first one. This will be the fourth now, and then the fifth, the next bill will be the fifth. But the first bill that we passed on March 4th was testing, testing, testing. Here we are a month and a half later, and we're finally in this bill having to insist that the administration focus on testing. They have ignored this over the past weeks, and that has been a loss of life and opportunity in our country. Testing, testing, contact tracing, quarantine,
and so can you
let's get it done. science.
Can you
science,
put a number
science.
Right now? I'm sorry to interrupt, but can you put a number now on how much more you expect Congress will spend on testing in the next round?
Well, in this round, we have $25 billion. We will need more. And there are scientists who are coming up with estimates as to what it will really take for us to be able to test the number of people in any given day, far more than the the administration has plans for right now, by their own scientists saying we can do this many in a day. The rest of the scientific world said that doesn't even come close. It's about one-third of what we need to do. So hopefully with this bill, which will call for a national strategy on testing, and to not only test, but to report on the demographics of it, how it is impacting different communities, is going to be very important. You cannot solve a problem unless you can define it, and we cannot define it until we test, and then do the contact tracing, and of course the incubation, isolation, in order to stop the spread of it, and to keep it out of the homes of those who are infected. We know what to do. Science tells us.
Madam Speaker, we know that you and President Trump have had, I think it's fair to say, a difficult relationship with one another in recent months. How much is this impeding the ability of the federal government to address this COVID-19 crisis?
What is impeding the federal government from addressing the COVID-19 crisis is the president's delay in all of this, and that has been deadly. Science. He has refused. We are insisting on the truth, and the president is engaged in a series of misrepresentations to the American people, and that is the impediment. I have tried to act in a bipartisan way, as I said, three bills in March, bipartisan. Easter, I had sort of an epiphany on Easter, that said we must call out the truth on this, because we cannot. It's one thing to overlook what happened in the past and be sad about that. It's another thing to let the misrepresentations continue. And so that's why I am saying that he's a poor leader. He ignores his own responsibility and assigns blame instead of taking responsibility, paying attention to science, recognizing the role of governance in all of this to get the job done for the American people. And so he's engaged in distractions like immigration, distractions like supporting people in the street. They're all distractions away from the known fact that he's a total failure when it comes to testing.
Something else I want to ask you about, that is the money, the billions of dollars that you wanted states to be able to spend on making sure their elections this fall, this November, are safe. This is something Democrats are pushing. Leader McConnell has said this is not a priority for him. He's not going to let it happen. He does hold the upper hand on this, doesn't he?
No, he doesn't. This is the same Mitch McConnell who came to the floor on April 9th and said, this is as far as we're going to go. The Democrats are holding this up. We're not going beyond this. And today he voted unanimously for the proposal that the Democrats put forward. No, this is about the lives, the livelihood of the American people, and the life of our democracy. And we do, we did in Wisconsin, it was like saying to the people, you go to the polls, and that it's just the same as if we invited you all to go to the Mardi Gras. This is dangerous. And so at this time in particular, we want people to be able to vote by mail and to be able to get a ballot in the mail, to have same-day registration. We had some very positive initiatives there. We got $400 million in the previous bill in CARE 1, and now we expect a need to get more. And there are Republicans I was a state party chair years ago. We would win on election day and lose when the Republican votes would come in by mail, because they were always so much better than we were at voting by mail. So I don't know why the president says if we have vote by mail, Republicans will never win any more elections. Maybe it's for other reasons, but it's certainly not by their ability and facility to vote by mail. But that's about our Constitution, to remove all obstacles to participation so that our democracy can thrive with the fullest participation of the American people. And then let the chips fall where they may.
Speaker Nancy Pelosi, we thank you very much.
Thank you. Thank you so much. My pleasure.
The historic declines in global oil prices continued today with negative effects seen in stock markets around the world. The sharp collapse in oil prices reflects the broader drop in demand all across areas of the economy as business activity everywhere remains at a near standstill. For a closer look at all of this and whether oil's decline could be a harbinger of trouble to come in other sectors, we turn to the New York Times economics reporter Neil Irwin, who has been following all these developments closely. So, Neil, first question, give us a little bit of background. What is behind this massive drop in oil prices right now?
So the simple story goes like this. We've been through this remarkable period over the last 2 months when all types of oil consumption has collapsed. Airplanes aren't flying, people aren't driving, usage of energy products is way, way down. But for oil production, you can't just flip it on and off like a switch. So oil has continued to be pumped from the ground despite the drying up of demand. This means there's a glut, there's more supply than demand. That's become so extreme that in Texas, in big parts of North America, we're running out of storage capacity to store all that extra oil. And that's how we ended up with negative prices for oil on Monday on the May futures contract.
And how much of this, Neil, has to do with where this oil is, whether it's in the U.S. or it's in the Middle East or someplace else?
That's a big part of it. So much of the U.S. oil supply is landlocked. It's hard to get it onto oil tankers. There are oil tankers around the world literally just sitting in the ocean, holding large amounts of oil to keep it off the market right now. This is a very unusual time. This is a time in which Saudi Arabia and Russia have been producing lots of oil. They've only recently agreed to try and pull that back. And again, demand is in free fall. No one is consuming energy at the rates they used to. And so until that corrects itself, until this extra supply can work its way through the system, we're going to have extremely low oil prices, maybe not negative, but very low numbers.
And what does that mean then, Neil, for the broader economy? I mean, how much of an effect is it having? We see the economy hurting because of the slowdown everywhere. But how much specifically is this energy sector oil price issue affecting the rest of the global economy?
So oil is the most economically important commodity in the world. And I think what it's telling us is something that really applies across all types of commodities and really all types of things that people buy, which is there is a glut. There is a worldwide collapse of demand. And that means there's all this unused capacity out there in the world. It's true of oil. It's true of agricultural commodities. A lot of, corn prices are down. It's true of things that are in the service sector. Empty restaurants, empty hotels, empty airplanes. Runways at major airports are like parking lots with airplanes just sitting there not flying anywhere. That's a very unusual situation. And what it amounts to is a global deflationary force. It means there's all this extra capacity sitting out there unused.
And in a nutshell, what's it going to take to get this right again?
Well, the truth is the public health response and getting to a point where people can go back to their usual consumption patterns is the only way to really end this. I think the question is, what can the government do? And that's what Speaker Pelosi was just speaking about, to try to grease the runway, make sure we can get through this period without undue personal hardship for individuals, so that we can then come out on the other end when the public health dimensions are solved and get back to business, return to jobs. But that said, there's a lot of scarring happening. There are a lot of people out of work. Can you reform those attachments quickly? That's really an open question, especially if this goes on a whole lot longer.
Neil Irwin, we thank you. Always good to have you with us.
Thanks, Judy.
In the day's other news, a bipartisan U.S. Senate report reaffirms that Russia did interfere in the 2016 U.S. election and will try it again this year. It's the latest in a series of reports by the Senate Intelligence Committee. It backs up the intelligence community's work, and it dismisses President Trump's claims that the findings were a hoax. In the 2020 presidential campaign, Democrat Joe Biden's team has reported its best fundraising month yet. The former vice president's operation says that it took in more than $46 million during March. Most of that take came early in the month before the coronavirus disrupted the economy. President Trump still has, though, a big advantage in fundraising with more than $240 million stockpiled. South Korea and China cast doubt today on reports that North Korea's leader Kim Jong-un is gravely ill. The report said that Kim had undergone surgery recently. The South Korean president's office said there is no sign of anything unusual. However, a leading South Korean lawmaker said it's not clear what's happening.
Someone told me Kim Jong-un had a surgery for cardiovascular problems. Another person told me he got an ankle surgery. And another told me that he is infected with the coronavirus. Looking at various circumstances, I believe that there are some unusual signs regarding Kim's health.
The report surfaced a week after Kim missed a key state ceremony and after his sister received a surprise high-level promotion. In Chile, anti-government protests have reignited despite a ban on large gatherings during the pandemic. At least 14 people were arrested late Monday as small groups demonstrated in Santiago. The protests came in defiance of a curfew. Near daily protests broke out last October over economic inequality. Back in this country, Oklahoma will not be allowed to enforce a ban on abortions during the pandemic, at least for now. A federal judge issued a preliminary injunction last night. The state had sought to include abortions with other elective procedures that are temporarily postponed. And the Scripps National Spelling Bee is being canceled for the first time since World War II. Organizers said today there is no safe way to hold the event during the pandemic. The competition had been scheduled for early June outside of Washington, D.C. Still to come on the NewsHour, COVID-19 and kidney disease, a deadly complication of the virus. To Uganda, where health officials are putting their knowledge of previous outbreaks to work. The hunt for a vaccine, medical scientists race to find a cure for coronavirus. Plus, scenes of silence. The pandemic brings cities worldwide to a standstill.
This is the PBS NewsHour from WETA Studios in Washington and in the West from the Walter Cronkite School of Journalism at Arizona State University.
Even as we learn more about this coronavirus, there are new questions we didn't expect about what else it may be doing to the body. In addition to the respiratory distress it causes, COVID-19 seems to be linked with increases for some patients in inflammation of the heart and other organ and tissue damage. None of these connections are conclusive, but William Brangham explores one of those connections that has a number of doctors concerned.
That's right. One of the many things that we're learning about this novel coronavirus is the impact that it is having on the kidneys. And for that, I'm joined now by Dr. Alan Kleiger. He's at the Yale University School of Medicine, and he co-chairs the COVID-19 response team for the American Society of Nephrology. Dr. Kleiger, thank you very much for being here.
Thank you.
Could you tell me when you first started to learn that what we think of as a respiratory virus is also damaging kidneys?
Well, some of the earliest reports out of China showed that among COVID-positive patients admitted to the hospital, as many as 40 or even 50% had evidence of some damage in the kidney. They had protein in their urine or blood in their urine, and 10% of them even had some decrease in kidney function. So we knew early on that the kidney was one of the targets.
And do we know why the virus impacts the kidneys?
It's not so clear, but there's been a lot of speculation about that. We know, for example, that the virus can attach to kidney cells through a specific receptor in the kidney. These same receptors are in other organs as well and can damage the kidney directly. We also know that in patients who are very sick, who need to be on ventilators and are in intensive care units, that the combined illness in the lung and other organs can sometimes cause a huge inflammatory reaction, and the body releases these things called cytokines, and they can in turn damage the kidney.
So what are the practical implications if I am someone who is infected with the coronavirus and I'm getting quite sick and it starts to damage my kidneys? What does that mean for me as a patient?
Yeah. Well, first of all, most people who are sick with this disease never get sick enough to be in the hospital and never get sick enough to have many organs damaged that way. But if you look specifically at patients sick enough to be in the intensive care unit from COVID-19, it looks in centers like New York that have a lot of disease that 30 or 40% of those patients may have evidence of kidney failure. There are even some places that there are as high as 50% of those intensive care unit patients who have kidney failure.
We know that's obviously a huge complication for the individual, but it's also got to put some stress on the ICU that is caring for them, because dialysis, that kidney care is not something that is easily procured, right?
Well, it's true. In centers like New York or other cities like Detroit or Chicago, first of all, many more intensive care units have had to be created to take care of patients who are so sick. And in those units, the provision of care like dialysis or like continuous replacement therapy, different kinds of dialysis treatments that treat kidney failure, are very intensive of both equipment and personnel.
So obviously that means ICU staff have to be beefed up, the amount of equipment have to be beefed up. Is it your sense that there are enough of those individuals and equipment to handle projected surge of cases?
Well, we know that best from the experience in New York, where last week many hospitals started running short of equipment and be concerned about those staff. You know, many people taking care of patients with kidney with COVID-19 themselves have been infected, and so often staff are out and ill. And so what we started hearing from New York was that the need for equipment and dialysis was four or five times usual, while staff available was sometimes 70 or 80% of what usually is used. So that combination has made it really critical in some places to bring in more staff and to bring in more equipment.
Long term, do we know what this virus does to the kidneys over the long term? Meaning, do people heal from this and can they restore traditional normal kidney function?
It's a good question, and this is early yet, and we don't have all the answers to that. What we do know is that there have been patients who have had acute kidney injury from this illness that they've recovered from, and where the kidneys have been able to go on and do what they've needed to without dialysis. But we also know there are some patients who still have evidence of kidney failure and need dialysis even after they've been released from the hospital.
Another one of these long-term impacts of this virus we're going to be living with for a very, very long time. Yeah. Dr. Alan Kleiger at the Yale University School of Medicine, thank you very much for your time.
Thank you.
Poor healthcare infrastructure in some African nations is leading to dire warnings from the UN about the toll that COVID-19 could take throughout the continent. But the East African nation of Uganda has only 58 confirmed cases so far. Experts say its experience with previous viral outbreaks, like the Ebola and Marburg viruses, mean it was already prepared to deal with COVID-19. Special correspondent Michael Balake reports from the capital, Kampala.
Uganda's first confirmed case of COVID-19 landed on a plane from Dubai on March 21st. More than 100 people were aboard the same flight, and the nation acted swiftly.
The passenger manifest has been retrieved, and all contacts are known as the passports of the travelers on this plane were retained at immigration, and all the travelers were put under quarantine.
Viral disease outbreaks are nothing new here. Uganda has been in a healthcare emergency since 2018, responding to outbreaks of Ebola, yellow fever, measles, and the Crimean Congo hemorrhagic fever. Uganda also successfully contained the deadly Marburg virus in 2017, limiting the outbreak to three deaths. Health officials say that gives Uganda an advantage over other countries in their fight against COVID-19.
We put in place measures to do surveillance because of the recent Ebola outbreak. and this virus is just coming in. So we already had measures of controlling movement in this region.
Health surveillance teams have been on duty at all border posts, land and air. Since last year, body temperature scanners have been in place at the Entebbe International Airport. Uganda has also built the capacity to prepare and swiftly test samples of different viral diseases at the Uganda Virus Research Institute laboratory.
As we are running now, we can do about 520 tests per day, but we have the capacity to expand that if we use all the machines and all additional technicians.
More than 1,000 Ugandans have been identified as a potential risk and have been put either in self-quarantine or institutional quarantine. Despite the relatively few cases, the government is already taking additional precautionary measures.
It is wise that we temporarily remove these concentration points by closing all the primary and secondary schools, pre-primary, as well as all the universities and tertiary institutions for 1 month.
The government has issued a ban on public gatherings at places of worship, restaurants, and nightclubs for 30 days. The country has also sealed its borders, except to cargo planes, trucks, and trains. Joint security teams of both the military and police are enforcing a 7 p.m. curfew across the country. There have also been reports of refugees entering the country through illegal border points, even though the COVID-19 measures announced by the government suspended new arrivals.
Nobody is allowed to move back and forth from what we call country of origin to the settlement in Uganda. And we have directed all our law enforcement officers to make sure that this directive is enforced to the letter.
The bad news is that everyone is a potential victim.
Ugandan legislator and pop star Robert Kyagulanyi, also known as Bobby Wine, has released a song to raise awareness of the COVID-19 pandemic. Stop. The coronavirus poses a major risk to human life, and this has forced the Ugandan president to announce a two-week lockdown of the entire country so that people can stay at home. Uganda's 75-year-old president has also released a video of his home workout routine in a bid to encourage Ugandans to stay indoors. The stay-at-home order is driving many into a spending spree to stock up on household essentials. The rush to stockpile has driven up the price of commodities.
Yesterday, but when I bought a kilo of beans at 4,000, yesterday I came back, it's at 5,000. So I don't know what is going on. I don't know what the government is saying about it. And we are worried of the aftermath of this situation.
The Ugandan president has threatened to revoke trading licenses of businesses that hike prices. For the PBS NewsHour, I'm Michael Baleke in Kampala.
Our science correspondent, Miles O'Brien, has spent the past 6 weeks in Seattle, Washington, reporting on the pandemic and making a film for our friends at Frontline about how things unfolded in the city where COVID-19 first landed in the U.S. William is back, and he talked with Miles in Seattle earlier today.
Miles, very, very good to see you. Before we talk about your Frontline film, which is airing tonight, let's address this public debate that is happening in the country about when to reopen, how to reopen. And according to almost all public health experts, until we get a solid vaccine, we're basically going to be muddling along trying to fight against this virus. Where does the search for a vaccine sit right now?
William, it is all scientific hands on deck all over the globe. There are 78 confirmed trials underway right now looking for a vaccine to attack this novel coronavirus. There are a couple of techniques that are novel techniques, not quite proven yet, which involve using DNA and RNA, the genetic material, to get the immune system response that you want inside the human body. The Chinese released the genetic sequence of this new coronavirus on January 10th. 63 days later, this trial vaccine was being injected into the first volunteer in one study run by Moderna. Another company with a similar idea, Inovio, says they're moving as quickly as they can. I spoke over the weekend with the CEO of the company, Dr. Joseph Kim.
We're hopeful we'll have the immune responses data and safety data from all 40 subjects in June. And the next step will be a larger phase two trial that will test the actual efficacy of the vaccine, meaning how effective is the vaccine in protecting a person from an actual infection. And that will involve around 500 to 1,000 volunteers. And we're hopeful that we can start that trial as early as this summer.
Now, William, those volunteers will be frontline healthcare providers, first responders. There's a couple of reasons for that. Number one, they are most at risk, of course. That goes without saying. But scientifically, because they are so exposed to the virus, it gives them a more concentrated pool of data, a better group of subjects in order to determine one way or another whether these vaccines are working.
So let's just say we do find a vaccine that does work. That's one challenge. The next challenge, of course, is how do we make the millions and billions of shots needed to cover the planet? How long would that likely take?
This is the part that kind of boggles the mind when you start talking about supply chain. We're talking about 7 billion customers, right? And in the cases of these viruses these vaccines that we're seeing, it's two doses. So we're talking about 14 billion doses of medicine. To imagine producing that in short order is hard to wrap your brain around it. There are people in the philanthropic realm. Bill Gates has indicated he might put some of his money into, you know, allowing this production to scale up. There are private companies, of course, ready to do this. But ultimately, it's going to require the government, philanthropy, and private companies working in concert if we're going to ramp up production to meet this need, which, after all, there is no bigger need than the planet.
I mean, short of getting that vaccine, of course, we've got to treat all the people who are sickened with COVID-19, and there's a lot of work on these antiviral drugs and other types of medications. I know that is a part of what's in your front line tonight. Can you tell us a bit more about that?
Yes, it's one of the antivirals, remdesivir, one of the possible treatments for coronavirus, came into play with patient number one here in the Puget Sound area. 35-year-old man, otherwise good health, had spent 6 weeks in the Wuhan region of China visiting family late December, early January, landed on U.S. soil January 15th at SeaTac Airport, became sick just a few days later, ends up in a clinic. And by the end of January, he's in a hospital in Everett, Providence Regional Hospital there, and starts to deteriorate. And this is where we pick up the story with the clinician who was in charge of his care, Dr. George Diaz.
Patient one was slipping fast, and there was no known treatment. Dr. Diaz told me he heard about an antiviral drug called remdesivir that some experts thought could potentially help. It would be an experiment, he said, but the patient was willing.
At that point, I contacted the FDA and Gilead, the manufacturer, to see if they would approve it. So the FDA gave us an approval to try it on a compassionate use basis, knowing that it had not been approved yet and that there were no trials available to base that decision on. We infused it the next day. He was still having very high fevers and still was requiring oxygen the day that we gave it to him. By the next day, his fevers resolved and they stayed gone. He felt much better. He felt like he had started beating the virus.
There was a stunning apparent recovery there, linked potentially to remdesivir. But bear in mind at this point, William, this was an anecdote, purely a case, one data point in the whole globe. So this had Dr. Diaz very intrigued, of course. And so he almost immediately got involved in some of the clinical trials that are underway on remdesivir. People who are exposed and dealing with the COVID-19 disease. And there are multiple trials all around the globe right now underway. And we don't have any firm data yet, but everything we're hearing is optimistic indications, including there was a leaked account that came out of Chicago, doctors expressing great optimism that they were having good efficacy with remdesivir, beating back this virus and allowing people to recover. It's important not to get too far ahead of these things. We want to have good science, but ultimately, if there's really strong indications, it's possible they will just stop the trials and start giving this drug to people who are really sick with COVID-19.
All right, Miles O'Brien, we'll be watching the film tonight. Thank you very much.
You're welcome, William.
And a reminder, Miles's film, Coronavirus Pandemic, airs tonight on Frontline on PBS.
The president stepped up to the White House podium again this evening to discuss the latest on a number of fronts. Our Yamiche Alcindor is here to bring us up to speed. So, Yamiche, the president has made some news with regard to immigration.
That's right, Judy. The president just announced at the White House that he's going to be planning to sign an executive order that will suspend immigration across the United States, with some exceptions, for 60 days. Now, he said that the executive order is still being written as of right now, but he expects to sign that as early as tomorrow. He said part of this is going to be halting green cards and people who are trying to come to the United States and immigrate to the United States permanently. He said people that are entering on a temporary basis won't be included in this suspension. It's important to know that I've been talking to White House sources all day, and they say that part of this means that farm workers and potentially healthcare workers won't be included in this immigration suspension. However, critics of the president say that this is really him scapegoating Americans. They also say that this is the president really making it seem as though immigrants are the problem, when really coronavirus, the virus itself, and testing is really the issue here. The president, though, said that he feels that he has to do this because he wants to protect American workers from getting jobs if they are laid off. And also, he said that healthcare, the people that are coming into hospitals, those need to be focused on helping Americans. But again, critics of the president, including some Republicans, say that this is the wrong move.
And Yamiche, it's an executive order, as you said. So does that mean there's no recourse on the part of anybody who disagrees with the president, whether it's Democrats in Congress, governors, or someone else?
Well, much like many of the things that the president has done, both during the coronavirus outbreak as well as prior to this outbreak, this executive order will be still subject to legal challenges. So critics of the president will likely be taking him to court. This could end up as far as even in the Supreme Court. We've seen the president be taken to court on things like the travel ban that was ultimately upheld but changed. The president, though, has halted a lot of immigration already. So there are supporters of the president who say, well, right now, if you're caught trying to get into the United States from Mexico and Canada and other countries, you're already turned away. So there are some people who say this is really the president just cementing what is already happening in the United States. But there are others who say this is a step forward, a step too far, and that this is, of course, putting into place a 60-day suspension. So this isn't just a small thing. They say this is a bigger step to that.
Some are saying what he's doing is unprecedented. Yamiche Alcindor following it all at the White House. Yamiche, thank you.
Thanks so much.
As much of the world continues to stay inside practicing social distancing, vibrant cities have gone quiet and given us a glimpse of what the world might be like without us in it. Jeffrey Brown has the story. It's part of our ongoing series on arts and culture, Canvas.
Times Square in New York. On a typical April day, more than 375,000 pedestrians pass through. If you've been, you know it can feel they're all there at once. But not now, when the usual bustle is all but gone. In a normal year, more than 30 million people visit Paris. making it the biggest tourist destination in the world. Today, as the French say, il n'y a pas un chat, not a cat in sight.
When you live in a touristy area, you should expect noise, crowds, foot traffic. And it's a big city, so obviously there are a lot of people. It's pleasant to see Paris like this, but we still feel that this is not normal.
Around the world, spaces that have long filled our imaginations are mostly empty, largely silent. As the poet Gerard Manley Hopkins wrote, all things counter, original, spare, strange. Even amid so much sickness and horror, a strange beauty.
Despite the horrible reasons that this is happening, I think that there's a lot of gifts to be had to have the entire world stop at the same time.
Sacred spaces. In St. Peter's Square, Pope Francis was a solitary figure as he delivered a special blessing to the world.
Donando la propria vita.
The holy city of Mecca is normally filled with Muslim pilgrims. This year, Saudi authorities suspended the pilgrimage completely. Places of romance. Rio de Janeiro's famed beaches, usually jam-packed. Now closed by the local government, patrolled by police. And the otherworldly light and magic of Venice. Its canals mostly devoid of activity, gondolas and ferries rocking gently. One result, the water is now more clear. It's true elsewhere as well. One silver lining to the upheaval, cleaner places, cleaner air. Pollution levels dropped so much over Wuhan, China, during its months-long lockdown, the change was visible in satellite images. A similar story in Milan, Italy. A marked decline in air pollution in March compared to last year. Los Angeles has seen its longest period of good air quality in 25 years. In fact, there may be something else in the air, a new song. Scientists are studying how the pandemic is impacting birds.
We literally have a worldwide experiment underway. There are actually a number of studies both in the US and in Europe that show that birds do respond to human anthropogenic noise by reducing their own songs, in some cases actually changing the frequency of their songs. And so it's a safe bet that in the much reduced noise sphere that they're experiencing right now, they're probably out there filling it up a little bit more than they would have otherwise.
And around the world, reports of other wildlife reclaiming now empty spaces. In southern India, a herd of elephants took over a road usually filled with traffic. In Thailand, a mob of monkeys brawled over food. With hardly any tourists to feed them, the monkeys are going hungry. And near Barcelona, Spain, wild boar descended from the hills and grazed in hedges that divide the boulevards. Sights and sounds rarely, if ever, experienced. All things counter, as the poet said, original, spare, strange. For the PBS NewsHour, I'm Jeffrey Brown.
Wouldn't it be wonderful if something good came out of this terrible time? And that is the NewsHour for tonight. I'm Judy Woodruff. Join us online and again right here tomorrow evening. For all of us at the PBS NewsHour, thank you. Please stay safe, and we'll see you soon.